The Grand Chessboard by Zbigniew Brzezinski, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. Chapter 7, Conclusion. The time has come for the United States to formulate and prosecute an integrated, comprehensive, and long-term geostrategy for all of Eurasia. This need arises out of the interaction between two fundamental realities. America is now the only global superpower, and Eurasia is the globe's central area. Hence, what happens to the distribution of power on the Eurasian continent will be of decisive importance to America's global primacy and to America's historical legacy. American global primacy is unique in its scope and character. It is a hegemony of a new type that reflects many of the features of the American democratic system. It is pluralistic, permeable, and flexible. Attained in the course of less than half a century, the principal geopolitical manifestation of that hegemony is America's unprecedented role on the Eurasian landmass. Hitherto the point of origin for all previous contenders for global power. America is now Europe's arbiter, with no major Eurasian issues soluble without America's participation, or contrary to America's interests. How the United States both manipulates and accommodates the principal geostrategic players on the Eurasian chessboard, and how it manages Eurasia's key geopolitical pivots will be critical to the longevity and stability of America's global primacy. In Europe, the key players will continue to be France and Germany, and America's central goal should be to consolidate and expand the existing democratic bridgehead on Eurasia's western periphery. In Eurasia's Far East, China is likely to be increasingly central, and America will not have a political foothold on the Asian mainland unless an American-Chinese geostrategic consensus is successfully nurtured. In the center of Eurasia, the space between an enlarging Europe and a regionally rising China will remain a geopolitical black hole, at least until Russia resolves its inner struggles over its post-imperial self-definition. While the region to the south of Russia, the Eurasian Balkans, threatens to become a cauldron of ethnic conflict and great power rivalry. In that context, for some time to come, for more than a generation, America's status as the world's premier power is unlikely to be contested by any single challenger. No nation-state is likely to match America in the four key dimensions of power – military, economic, technological, and cultural – that cumulatively produce decisive global political clout. Short of a deliberate or unintentional American abdication, the only real alternative to American global leadership in the foreseeable future is international anarchy. In that respect, it is correct to assert that America has become, as President Clinton put it, the world's indispensable nation. It is important to stress here both the fact of that indispensability and the actuality of the potential for global anarchy. The disruptive consequences of population explosion, poverty-driven migration, radicalizing urbanization, ethnic and religious hostilities, and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction would become unmanageable if the existing and underlying nation-state-based framework of even rudimentary geopolitical stability were itself to fragment. Without sustained and directed American involvement, before long the forces of global disorder could come to dominate the world scene. And the possibility of such a fragmentation is inherent in the geopolitical tensions not only of today's Eurasia, but of the world more generally. The resulting risks to global stability are likely to be further increased by the prospect of a more general degradation of the human condition. Particularly in the poorer countries of the world, the demographic explosion and simultaneous urbanization of these populations are rapidly generating a congestion not only of the disadvantaged, but especially of the hundreds of millions of unemployed and increasingly restless young, whose level of frustration is growing at an exponential rate. Modern communications intensify their rupture with traditional authority, while making them increasingly conscious and resentful of global inequality and thus more susceptible to extremist mobilization. On the one hand, the rising phenomenon of global migrations, already reaching into the tens of millions, may act as a temporary safety valve, but on the other hand, it is also likely to serve as a vehicle for the transcontinental conveyance of ethnic and social conflicts. The global stewardship that America has inherited is hence likely to be buffeted by turbulence, tension, and at least sporadic violence. The new and complex international order, shaped by American hegemony and within which the threat of war is off the table, is likely to be restricted to those parts of the world where American power has been reinforced by democratic socio-political systems and by elaborate external multilateral, but also American-dominated, frameworks. An American geostrategy for Eurasia will thus be competing with the forces of turbulence. In Europe, there are signs that the momentum of integration and enlargement is waning, and that the traditional European nationalisms may reawaken before long. Large-scale unemployment persists, even in the most successful European states, breeding xenophobic reactions that could suddenly cause a lurch in French or German politics towards significant political extremism and inward-oriented chauvinism. Indeed, a genuine pre-revolutionary situation could even be in the making. The historical timetable of Europe, outlined in Chapter 3, will be met only if Europe's aspirations for unity are both encouraged and even prodded by the United States. The uncertainties regarding Russia's future are even greater, and the prospects for a positive evolution much more tenuous. It is therefore imperative for America to shape a geopolitical context that is congenial to Russia's assimilation into a larger setting of growing European cooperation, and that also fosters the self-reliant independence of its newly sovereign neighbours. Yet the viability of, say, Ukraine or Uzbekistan, not to speak of the ethnically bifurcated Kazakhstan, will remain uncertain, especially if American attenuation becomes diverted by new internal crises in Europe, by a growing gap between Turkey and Europe, or by intensifying hostility in American-Iranian relations. The potential for an eventual grand accommodation with China could also be aborted by a future crisis over Taiwan, or because internal Chinese political dynamics prompt the emergence of an aggressive and hostile regime, or simply because American-Chinese relations turn sour. China could then become a highly destabilizing force in the world, imposing enormous strains on the American-Japanese relationship, and perhaps also generating a disruptive geopolitical disorientation in Japan itself. In that setting, the stability of Southeast Asia would certainly be at risk, and one can only speculate how the confluence of these events would impact on the posture and cohesion of India, a country critical to the stability of South Asia. These observations serve as a reminder that neither the new global problems that go beyond the scope of the nation-state, nor more traditional geopolitical concerns are likely to be resolved, or even contained, if the underlying geopolitical structure of global power begins to crumble. With warning signs on the horizon across Europe and Asia, any successful American policy must focus on Eurasia as a whole and be guided by a geostrategic design. A geostrategy for Eurasia. The point of departure for the needed policy has to be hard-nosed recognition of the three unprecedented conditions that currently define the global geopolitical state of world affairs. For the first time in history, 1. A single state is a truly global power. 2. A non-Eurasian state is a globally preeminent state. And 3. The globe's central arena, Eurasia, is dominated by a non-Eurasian power. However, a comprehensive and integrated geostrategy for Eurasia must also be based on recognition of the limits of America's effective power and the inevitable attrition over time of its scope. As noted earlier, the very scale and diversity of Eurasia, as well as the potential power of some of its states, limit the depth of American influence and the degree of control over the course of events. This condition places a premium on geostrategic insight and on the deliberately selective deployment of America's resources on the huge Eurasian chessboard. And since America's unprecedented power is bound to diminish over time, the priority must be to manage the rise of other regional powers in ways that do not threaten America's global primacy. As in chess, American global planners must think several moves ahead, anticipating possible countermoves. A sustainable geostrategy must therefore distinguish between the short-run perspective, the next 5 years or so, the middle term, up to 20 or so years, and the long run, which is beyond 20 years. Moreover, these phases must be viewed not as a watertight compartment, but as part of a continuum. The first phase must gradually and consistently lead into the second, indeed, be deliberately pointed toward it. And the second must then subsequently lead to the third. In the short run, it is in America's interest to consolidate and perpetuate the prevailing geopolitical pluralism on the map of Eurasia. That puts a premium on maneuver and manipulation in order to prevent the emergence of a hostile coalition that could eventually seek to challenge America's primacy. Not to mention the remote possibility of any one particular state seeking to do so. By the middle term, the foregoing should gradually yield to a greater emphasis on the emergence of increasingly important but strategically compatible partners who, prompted by American leadership, might help to shape a more cooperative trans-Eurasian security system. Eventually, in the much longer run still, the foregoing could phase into a global core of genuinely shared political responsibility. The most immediate task is to make certain that no states or combinations of states gains the capacity to expel the United States from Eurasia, or even to diminish significantly its decisive arbitrating role. However, the consolidation of transcontinental geopolitical pluralism should not be viewed as an end in itself, but only as a means to achieve the middle-term goal of shaping genuine strategic partnerships in the key regions of Eurasia. It is unlikely that democratic America will wish to be permanently engaged in the difficult, absorbing, and costly task of managing Eurasia by constant manipulation and maneuver, backed by American military resources, in order to prevent regional domination by any one power. The first phase must, therefore, logically and deliberately lead into the second one, in which a benign American hegemony still discourages others from posing a challenge, not only by making the costs of the challenge too high, but also by not threatening the vital interests of Eurasia's potential regional aspirants. What that requires specifically, as the middle-term goal, is the fostering of genuine partnerships, predominant among them those with a more united and politically defined Europe, and with a regionally preeminent China, as well as with, one hopes, a post-imperial and Europe-orientated Russia, and, on the southern fringe of Eurasia, with a regionally stabilizing and democratic India. But it will be the success or failure of the effort to forge broader strategic relationships with Europe and China, respectively, that will shape the defining context for Russia's role, either positive or negative. It follows that a wider Europe and an enlarged NATO will serve well both the short-term and longer-term goals of US policy. A larger Europe will expand the range of American influence and, through the admission of new Central European members, also increase in the European councils the number of states with a pro-American proclivity, without simultaneously creating a Europe politically so integrated that it could soon challenge the United States on geopolitical matters of high importance to America elsewhere, particularly in the Middle East. A politically defined Europe is also essential to the progressive assimilation of Russia into a system of global cooperation. Admittedly, America cannot on its own generate a more united Europe. That is up to the Europeans, especially the French and the Germans. But America can obstruct the emergence of a more united Europe. And that could prove calamitous for stability in Eurasia, and thus for America's own interests. Indeed, unless Europe becomes more united, it is likely to become more disunited again. Accordingly, as stated earlier, it is vital that America work closely with both France and Germany in seeking a Europe that is politically viable, a Europe that remains linked to the United States, and a Europe that widens the scope of the cooperative democratic international system. Making a choice between France and Germany is not the issue. Without either France or Germany, there will be no Europe, and without Europe, there will be no trans-Eurasian system. In practical terms, the foregoing will require gradual accommodation to a shared leadership in NATO, greater acceptance of France's concerns for a European role not only in Africa, but also in the Middle East, and continued support for the eastward expansion of the EU, even as the EU becomes a more politically and economically assertive global player. A transatlantic free trade agreement, already advocated by a number of prominent Atlantic leaders, could also mitigate the risk of growing economic rivalry between a more united EU and the United States. In any case, the EU's eventual success in burying the centuries-old European nationalistic antagonisms with their globally disruptive effects would be well worth some gradual diminution in America's decisive role as Eurasia's current arbiter. The enlargement of NATO and the EU would serve to reinvigorate Europe's own waning sense of a larger vocation, while consolidating, to the benefit of both America and Europe, the democratic gains won through the successful termination of the Cold War. At stake in this effort is nothing less than America's long-range relationship with Europe itself. A new Europe is still taking shape. And if that new Europe is to remain geopolitically a part of the Euro-Atlantic space, the expansion of NATO is essential. By the same token, a failure to widen NATO, now that the commitment has been made, would shatter the concepts of an expanding Europe and demoralize the Central Europeans. It could only reignite currently dormant or dying Russian geopolitical aspirations in Central Europe. Indeed, the failure of the American-led effort to expand NATO could reawaken even more ambitious Russian desires. It is not yet evident, and the historical record is strongly to the contrary, that the Russian political elites shares Europe's desire for a strong and enduring American political and military presence. Therefore, while the fostering of an increasingly cooperative relationship with Russia is clearly desirable, it is important for America to send a clear message about its global priorities. If a choice has to be made between a larger Euro-Atlantic system and a better relationship with Russia, the former has to rank incomparably higher to America. For that reason, any accommodation with Russia on the issue of NATO enlargement should not entail an outcome that has the effect of making Russia a de facto decision-making member of the alliance, thereby diluting NATO's special Euro-Atlantic character, while simultaneously relegating its newly admitted members to second-class status. That would create opportunities for Russia to resume not only the efforts to regain a sphere of influence in Central Europe, but to use its presence within NATO to play on any American-European disagreements in order to reduce the American role in European affairs. It is also crucial that, as Central Europe enters NATO, any new security assurances to Russia regarding the region to be truly reciprocal and thus mutually reassuring. Restrictions on the deployment of NATO troops and nuclear weapons on the soil of new members can be an important factor in allaying legitimate Russian concerns, but these should be matched by symmetrical Russian assurances regarding the demilitarization of the potentially strategically menacing salient of Kaliningrad, and by limits on major troop deployments near the borders of the prospective new members of NATO and the EU. While all of Russia's newly independent Western neighbours are anxious to have a stable and cooperative relationship with Russia, the fact is that they continue to fear it for historically understandable reasons. Hence, the emergence of an equitable NATO-EU accommodation with Russia would be welcomed by all Europeans as a signal that Russia is finally making the much-desired post-imperial choice in favour of Europe. That choice could pave the way for a wider effort to enhance Russia's status and esteem. Formal membership in the G7, as well as the upgrading of the policy-making machinery of the OSCE, within which a special security committee composed of America, Russia, and several key European countries could be established, would create opportunities for constructive Russian engagement in shaping both the political and security dimensions of Europe. Coupled with ongoing Western financial assistance to Russia, along with the development of much more ambitious schemes for linking Russia more closely to Europe through new highway and railroad networks, the process of giving substance to a Russian choice in favour of Europe would move forward significantly. Russia's longer-term role in Eurasia will depend largely on the historic choice that Russia has to make, perhaps still in the course of this decade, regarding its own self-definition. Even with Europe and China increasing the radius of their respective regional influence, Russia will remain in charge of the world's largest single piece of real estate. It spans 10 time zones and is territorially twice as large as either the United States or China, dwarfing in that regard even the enlarged Europe. Hence, territorial deprivation is not Russia's central problem. Rather, the huge Russia has to face squarely and draw the proper implications from the fact that both Europe and China are already economically more powerful, and that China is also threatening to outpace Russia on the road to social modernization. In these circumstances, it should become more evident to the Russian political elite that Russia's first priority is to modernize itself rather than to engage in a futile effort to regain its former status as a global power. Given the enormous size and diversity of the country, a decentralized political system based on the free market would be more likely to unleash the creative potential of both the Russian people and the country's vast natural resources. In turn, such a more decentralized Russia would be less susceptible to imperial mobilization. A loosely confederated Russia, composed of a European Russia, a Siberian Russia, and a Far Eastern Republic, would also find it easier to cultivate closer economic relations with Europe, with the new states of Central Asia, and with the Orient, which would thereby accelerate Russia's own development. Each of the three confederated entities would also be more able to tap local creative potential, stifled for centuries by Moscow's heavy bureaucratic hand. A clear choice by Russia in favour of the European option over the imperial one will be more likely if America successfully pursues the second imperative strand of its strategy towards Russia, namely, reinforcing the prevailing geopolitical pluralism in the post-Soviet space. Such reinforcement will serve to discourage any imperial temptations. A post-imperial and Europe-orientated Russia should actually view American efforts to that end as helpful in consolidating regional stability and in reducing the possibility of conflicts among its new, potentially unstable southern frontiers. But the policy of consolidating geopolitical pluralism should not be conditioned on the existence of a good relationship with Russia. Rather, it is also important insurance in the case such a good relationship fails to develop, as it creates impediments to the re-emergence of any truly threatening Russian imperial policy. It follows that political and economic support for both the key newly independent states is an integral part of a broader strategy of Eurasia, the consolidation of a sovereign Ukraine, which in the meantime redefines itself as a Central European state and engages in closer integration with Central Europe, is a critically important component of such a policy, as is the fostering of a closer relationship with such strategically pivotal states as Azerbaijan and Uzbekistan, in addition to the more generalized efforts to open up Central Asia, in spite of Russian impediments, to the global economy. Large-scale international investment in an increasingly accessible Caspian Central Asian region would not only help to consolidate the independence of its new countries, but in the long run would also benefit a post-imperial and democratic Russia. The tapping of the region's energy and mineral resources would generate prosperity, prompting a greater sense of stability and security in the area, while perhaps also reducing the risks of Balkan-type conflicts. The benefits of accelerated regional development, funded by external investment, would also radiate to the adjoining Russian provinces, which tend to be economically underdeveloped. Moreover, once the region's new ruling elites come to realize that Russia acquiesces in the region's integration into the global economy, they will become less fearful of the political consequences of close economic relations with Russia. In time, a non-imperial Russia could thus gain acceptance as the region's preeminent economic partner, even though it is no longer its imperial ruler. To promote a stable and independent Southern Caucasus and Central Asia, America must be careful not to alienate Turkey and should explore whether an improvement in American-Iranian relations is feasible. A Turkey that feels that it is an outcast from Europe, which it has been seeking to join, will become a more Islamic Turkey, more likely to veto the enlargement of NATO out of spite and less likely to cooperate with the West in seeking both to stabilize and integrate a secular Central Asia into the world community. Accordingly, America should use its influence in Europe to encourage Turkey's eventual admission to the EU, and should make a point of treating Turkey as a European state, provided internal Turkish politics do not take a dramatic turn in the Islamist direction. Regular consultations with Ankara regarding the future of the Caspian Sea Basin and the Central Asia would foster in Turkey a sense of strategic partnership with the United States. America should also strongly support Turkish aspirations to have a pipeline from Baku in Azerbaijan to Ceyhan on the Turkish Mediterranean coast, serve as a major outlet for the Caspian Sea Basin's energy resources. In addition, it is not in America's interest to perpetrate American-Iranian hostility. Any eventual reconciliation should be based on the recognition of a mutual strategic interest in stabilizing what currently is a very volatile regional environment for Iran. Admittedly, any such reconciliation must be pursued by both sides, and is not a favor granted by one to the other. A strong, even religiously motivated but not fanatically anti-Western Iran is in the US interest, and ultimately, even the Iranian political elite may recognize that reality. In the meantime, American long-range interests in Eurasia would be better served by abandoning existing US objections to closer Turkish-Iranian economic cooperation, especially in the construction of new pipelines, and also to the construction of other links between Iran, Azerbaijan, and Turkmenistan. Long-term American participation in the financing of such projects would, in fact, also be in the American interest. India's potential role also needs to be highlighted, although it is currently a relatively passive player on the Eurasian scene. India is contained geopolitically by the Chinese-Pakistani coalition, while a weak Russia cannot offer it the political support once provided by the Soviet Union. However, the survival of its democracy is of importance in that it refutes, better than volumes of academic debate, the notion that human rights and democracy are purely a parochial Western manifestation. India proves that anti-democratic Asian values, propagated by spokesmen from Singapore to China, are simply anti-democratic, but not necessarily characteristic of Asia. India's failure, by the same token, would be a blow to the prospects for democracy and would remove from the scene a power that contributes to greater balance in the Asian scene, especially given China's rise to geopolitical preeminence. It follows that a progressive engagement of India in discussions pertaining to regional stability, especially regarding the future of Central Asia, is becoming timely, not to mention the promotion of more directly bilateral connections between American and Indian defense communities. Geopolitical pluralism in Eurasia as a whole will neither be attainable nor stable without a deepening strategic understanding between America and China. It follows that a policy of engaging China in a serious strategic dialogue, eventually perhaps in a three-way effort that involves Japan as well, is the necessary first step in enhancing China's interest in an accommodation with America that reflects the several geopolitical interests, especially in Northeast Asia and Central Asia, the two countries in fact share in common. It also behooves America to eliminate any uncertainties regarding America's own commitment to the One China policy, lest the Taiwan issue fester and worsen, especially after China's absorption of Hong Kong. By the same token, it is in China's own interest to make that absorption a successful demonstration of the principle that even a greater China can tolerate and safeguard increased diversity in its internal political arrangements. while, as argued earlier in chapters 4 and 6, any would-be Chinese-Russian-Iranian coalition against America is unlikely to gel beyond some occasional tactical posturing, it is important for the United States to deal with China in a fashion that does not drive Beijing in that direction. In any such anti-hegemonic alliance, China would be the linchpin. It would be the strongest and the most dynamic and thus the leading component. Such a coalition could only emerge around a disaffected, frustrated, and hostile China. Neither Russia nor Iran has the wherewithal to be the central magnet for such a coalition. An American-Chinese strategic dialogue regarding the areas that both countries desire to see free of domination by other aspiring hegemons is therefore imperative. But to make progress, the dialogue should be sustained and serious. In the course of such communication, more contentious issues pertaining to Taiwan and even to human rights could then be addressed more persuasively. Indeed, the point can be made credibly that the issue of China's internal liberalization is not a purely domestic Chinese affair, since only a democratizing and prosperous China has any prospect of peacefully enticing Taiwan. Any attempt at forcible reunification would not only place the American-Chinese relationship in jeopardy, but would inevitably generate adverse consequences for China's capacity to attract foreign capital and sustain its development. China's own aspirations to regional preeminence and global status would thereby be victimized. Although China is emerging as a regionally dominant power, it is not likely to become a global one for a long time to come, for the reasons stated in Chapter 6, and paranoiac fears of China as a global power are breeding megalomania in China, while perhaps also becoming the source of a self-fulfilling prophecy of intensified American-Chinese hostility. Accordingly, China should be neither contained nor propitiated. It should be treated with respect as the world's largest developing state, and, so far at least, a rather successful one. Its geopolitical role, not only in the Far East, but in Eurasia as a whole, is likely to grow as well. Hence, it would make sense to co-opt China into the G7 annual summit of the world's leading countries, especially since Russia's inclusion has widened the summit's focus from economics to politics. As China becomes more integrated into the world system, and hence less able and less inclined to exploit its regional primacy and in a politically obtuse fashion, it also follows that a de facto emergence of a Chinese sphere of deference in areas of historic interest to China is likely to be part of the emerging Eurasian structure of geopolitical accommodation. Whether a united Korea will oscillate towards such a sphere depends much on the degree of Japanese-Korean reconciliation, which America should more actively encourage. But in any case, the reunification of Korea without an accommodation with China is unlikely. A greater China at some point will inevitably press for a resolution of the issue of Taiwan. But the degree of China's inclusion in an increasingly binding set of international economic and political links may also have a positive impact on the nature of Chinese domestic politics. If China's absorption of Hong Kong proves not to be repressive, Deng's formula for Taiwan of one country, two systems can become redefined as one country, several systems. That might make reunification more acceptable to the parties concerned, which again reinforces the point that without some political evolution of China itself, a peaceful reconstruction of one China will not be possible. In any case, for historical as well as geopolitical reasons, China should consider America its natural ally. Unlike Japan or Russia, America has never had any territorial designs on China, and unlike Great Britain, it never humiliated China. Moreover, without a viable strategic consensus with America, China is not likely to be able to keep attracting the massive foreign investment so necessary to its economic growth and thus also to its attainment of regional preeminence. For the same reason, without an American-Chinese strategic accommodation as the eastern anchor of America's involvement in Eurasia, America will not have a geostrategy for mainland Asia, and without a geostrategy for mainland Asia, America will not have a geostrategy for Eurasia. Thus, for America, China's regional power, co-opted into a wider framework of international cooperation, can be a vitally important geostrategic asset. In that regard, co-equally important with Europe, and more weighty than Japan in assuring Eurasia's stability. However, unlike the European situation, a democratic bridgehead on the eastern mainland will not soon emerge. That makes it all the more important that America's efforts to nurture a deepening strategic relationship with China be based on the unambiguous acknowledgement that a democratic and politically successful Japan is America's premier Pacific and key global partner. Though Japan cannot become a dominant Asian regional power, given the strong regional aversion it evokes, it can become a leading international one. Tokyo can carve out a globally influential role by cooperating closely with the United States regarding what might be called the new agenda of global concerns, while avoiding any futile and potentially counterproductive efforts to become a regional power itself. The task of American statesmanship should hence be to steer Japan in that direction. An American-Japanese free trade agreement, creating a common economic space, would fortify the connection and promote the goal, and hence its utility should be jointly examined. It is through a close political relationship with Japan that America will more safely be able to accommodate China's regional aspirations, while opposing its more arbitrary manifestations. Only on that basis can an intricate three-way accommodation, one that involves America's global power, China's regional preeminence, and Japan's international leadership, be contrived. However, that broad geostrategic accommodation could be undermined by an unwise expansion of Japanese-American military cooperation. Japan's central role should not be that of America's unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Far East, nor should it be America's principal Asian military partner or a potential Asian regional power. Misguided efforts to promote any of the foregoing would serve to cut America off from the Asian mainland, to vitiate the prospects of reaching a strategic consensus with China, and thus to frustrate America's capacity to consolidate stable geopolitical pluralism throughout Eurasia. A Trans-Eurasian Security System. The stability of Eurasia's geopolitical pluralism, precluding the appearance of a single dominant power, would be enhanced by the eventual emergence, perhaps sometime early in the next century, of a Trans-Eurasian Security System, a TESS. Such a transcontinental security agreement should embrace an expanded NATO, connected by a cooperative charter with Russia, and China as well as Japan, which would still be connected to the United States by bilateral security treaty. But to get there, NATO must first expand, while engaging Russia in a larger regional framework of security cooperation. In addition, the Americans and Japanese must closely consult and collaborate in setting in motion a triangular political security dialogue in the Far East that engages China. Three-way American-Japanese-Chinese security talks could eventually involve more Asian participants and later leads to a dialogue between them and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. In turn, such a dialogue could pave the way for a series of conferences by all European and Asian states, thereby beginning the process of institutionalizing a transcontinental security system. In time, a more formal structure could begin to take shape, prompting the emergence of a trans-Eurasian security system that, for the first time, would span the entire continent. The shaping of that system, defining its substance and then institutionalizing it, could become the major architectural initiative of the next decade, once the policies I outlined earlier have created the necessary preconditions. Such a broad transcontinental security framework could also contain a standing security committee composed of the major Eurasian entities in order to enhance TESS's ability to promote effective cooperation on issues critical to global stability. America, Europe, China and Japan, a confederated Russia and India, as well as perhaps some other countries, might serve together as the core of such a more structured transcontinental system. The eventual emergence of TESS could gradually relieve America of some of its burdens, even while perpetuating its decisive role as Eurasia's stabilizer and arbitrator. Beyond the last global superpower. In the long run, global politics are bound to become increasingly uncongenial to the concentration of hegemonic power in the hands of a single state. Hence, America is not only the first, as well as the only, truly global superpower, but it is also likely to be the very last. That is so not only because nation-states are gradually becoming increasingly permeable, but also because knowledge as power is becoming more diffuse, more shared, and less constrained by national boundaries. Economic power is also likely to become more dispersed. In the years to come, no single power is likely to reach the level of 30% or so of the world's GDP that America sustained throughout much of this century, not to speak of the 50% at which it crested in 1945. Some estimates suggest that by the end of this decade, America will still account for about 20% of global GDP, declining perhaps to about 10 to 15% by 2020, as other powers, Europe, China, and Japan, increase their relative share to more or less the American level. But global economic preponderance by a single entity of the sort that America attained in the course of this century is unlikely, and that has obviously far-reaching military and political implications. Moreover, the very multinational and exceptional character of American society has made it easier for America to universalize its hegemony without letting it appear to be a strictly national one. For example, an effort by China to seek global primacy would inevitably be viewed by others as an attempt to impose a national hegemony. To put it very simply, anyone can become an American, but only a Chinese can be Chinese. And that places an additional and significant barrier in the way of any essentially national global hegemony. Accordingly, once American leadership begins to fade, America's current global predominance is unlikely to be replicated by any single state. Thus, the key question for the future is, what will America bequeath to the world as the enduring legacy of its primacy? The answer depends in part on how long that primacy lasts, and on how energetically America shapes a framework of key power partnerships that over time can be more formally instituted. In fact, the window of historical opportunity for America's constructive exploitation of its global power could prove to be relatively brief, for both domestic and external reasons. A genuinely populist democracy has never before attained international supremacy. The pursuit of power, and especially the economic costs and human sacrifice that the exercise of such power often requires, are not generally congenial to democratic instincts. Democratization is inimical to imperial mobilization. Indeed, the critical uncertainty regarding the future may well be whether America might become the first superpower unable or unwilling to wield its power. Might it become an impotent global power? Public opinion polls suggest that only a small minority, 13%, of Americans favor the proposition that, as the sole remaining superpower, the US should continue to be the preeminent world leader in solving international problems. An overwhelming majority, 74%, prefer that America do its fair share in efforts to solve international problems together with other countries. Moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstances of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. Such a consensus generally existed throughout World War II and even during the Cold War. It was rooted, however, not only in deeply shared democratic values, which the public sensed were being threatened, but also in a cultural and ethnic affinity for the preponderantly European victims of hostile totalitarianisms. In the absence of a comparable external challenge, American society may find it much more difficult to reach agreement regarding foreign policies that cannot be directly related to central beliefs and widely shared cultural ethnic sympathies, and that still require an enduring and sometimes costly imperial engagement. If anything, two extremely varying views on the implications of America's historic victory in the Cold War are likely to be politically more appealing. On the one hand, the view that the end of the Cold War justifies a significant reduction in America's global engagement, irrespective of the consequences for America's global standing, and on the other, the perception that the time has come for genuine international multilateralism, to which America should even yield some of its sovereignty. Both extremes command the loyalty of committed constituencies. More generally, cultural change in America may also be uncongenial to the sustained exercise abroad of genuinely imperial power. That exercise requires a high degree of doctrinal motivation, intellectual commitment, and patriotic gratification. Yet the dominant culture of the country has become increasingly fixated on mass entertainment that has been heavily dominated by personally hedonistic and socially escapist themes. The cumulative effect has made it increasingly difficult to mobilize the needed political consensus on behalf of sustained and also occasionally costly American leadership abroad. Mass communications have been playing a particularly important role in that regard, generating a strong revulsion against any selective use of force that entails even low levels of casualties. In addition, both America and Western Europe have been finding it difficult to cope with the cultural consequences of social hedonism and the dramatic decline in the centrality of religious-based values in society. The parallels with the decline of the imperial system summarized in Chapter 1 are striking in that respect. The resulting cultural crisis has been compounded by the spread of drugs and, especially in America, by its linkage to the racial issue. Lastly, the rate of economic growth is no longer able to keep up with growing material expectations, with the latter stimulated by a culture that places a premium on consumption. It is no exaggeration to state that a sense of historical anxiety, perhaps even pessimism, is becoming palpable in the more articulate sectors of Western society. Almost half a century ago, a noted historian, Hans Kohn, having observed the tragic experience of two world wars and the debilitating consequences of the totalitarian challenge, worried that the West may have become fatigued and exhausted. Indeed, he feared that, quote, 20th century man has become less confident than his 19th century ancestor was. He has witnessed the dark powers of history in his own experience. Things which seemed to belong to the past have reappeared. Fanatical faith, infallible leaders, slavery and massacres, the uprooting of whole populations, ruthlessness and barbarism, close quote. The lack of confidence has been intensified by widespread disappointment with the consequences of the end of the Cold War. Instead of a New World Order, based on consensus and harmony, things which seemed to belong to the past have all of a sudden become the future. Although ethnic national conflicts may no longer pose the risk of a central war, they do threaten the peace in significant parts of the globe. Thus, war is not likely to become obsolete for some time to come. With the more endowed nations constrained by their own higher technological capacity for self-destruction, as well as by self-interest, war may have become a luxury that only the poor peoples of the world can afford. In the foreseeable future, the impoverished two-thirds of humanity may not be motivated by the restraint of the privileged. It is also noteworthy that international conflicts and acts of terrorism have so far been remarkably devoid of any use of weapons of mass destruction. How long that self-restraint may hold is inherently unpredictable, but the increasing availability, not only of states but also to organised groups, of the means to inflict massive casualties by the use of nuclear or biological weapons also inevitably increases the probability of their employment. In brief, America, as the world's premier power, does face a narrow window of historical opportunity. The present moment of relative global peace may be short-lived. This prospect underlines the urgent need for an American engagement in the world that is deliberately focused on the enhancement of international geopolitical stability and that is capable of reviving in the West a sense of historical optimism. That optimism requires the demonstrated capacity to deal simultaneously with internal social and external geopolitical challenges. However, the rekindling of Western optimism and the universalism of the West's values are not exclusively dependent on America and Europe. Japan and India demonstrate that the notions of human rights and the centrality of the democratic experiment can be valid in Asian settings as well, both in highly developed ones and in those that are still only developing. The continued democratic success of Japan and India is, therefore, also of enormous importance in sustaining a more confident perspective regarding the future political shape of the globe. Indeed, their experience, as well as that of South Korea and Taiwan, suggests that China's continued economic growth, coupled with pressures from outside for change generated by greater international inclusion, might perhaps also lead to the progressive democratization of the Chinese system. Meeting these challenges is America's burden, as well as its unique responsibility. Given the reality of American democracy, an effective response will require generating a public understanding of the continuing importance of American power in shaping a widening framework of stable geopolitical cooperation, one that is simultaneously averts global anarchy and successfully defers the emergence of a new power challenge. These goals, averting global anarchy and impeding the emergence of a power rival, are inseparable from the longer-range definition of the purpose of America's global engagement, namely, that of foregoing an enduring framework of global geopolitical cooperation. Unfortunately, to date, efforts to spell out a new central and worldwide objective for the United States in the wake of the termination of the Cold War have been one-dimensional. They have failed to link the needs to improve the human condition with the imperative of preserving the centrality of American power in the world affairs. Several such recent attempts can be identified. During the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, the advocacy of assertive multilateralism did not sufficiently take into account the basic realities of contemporary power. Later on, the alternative emphasis on the notion that America should focus on global democratic enlargement did not adequately take into account the continuing importance to America of maintaining global stability or even of promoting some expedient, but regrettably not democratic, power relationships, as with China. As the central US priority, more narrowly focused appeals have been even less satisfactory, such as those concentrating on the elimination of prevailing injustice in the global distribution of income, on shaping a special, mature strategic partnership with Russia, or on containing weapons proliferation. Other alternatives, that America should concentrate on safeguarding the environment or, more narrowly, on combating local wars, have also tended to ignore the central realities of global power. As a result, none of the foregoing formulations have fully addressed the need to create minimal global geopolitical stability as the essential foundation for the simultaneous protraction of American hegemony and the effective aversion of international anarchy. In brief, the US policy goal must be unapologetically twofold: to perpetuate America's own dominant position for at least a generation and preferably longer still, and to create a geopolitical framework that can absorb the inevitable shocks and strains of social political change while evolving into the geopolitical core of shared responsibility for peaceful global management. A prolonged phase of gradually expanding cooperation with key Eurasian partners, both stimulated and arbitrated by America, can also help to foster the preconditions for an eventual upgrading of the existing and increasingly antiquated UN structures. A new distribution of responsibilities and privileges can then take into account the changed realities of global power, so drastically different from those of 1945. These efforts will have the added historical advantage of benefiting from the new web of global linkages that is growing exponentially outside the more traditional nation-state system. That web, woven by multinational corporations, NGOs, non-governmental organizations, with many of them transnational in character, and scientific communities, and reinforced by the internet, already creates an informal global system that is inherently congenial to more institutionalized and inclusive global cooperation. In the course of the next several decades, a functioning structure of global cooperation, based on geopolitical realities, could thus emerge and gradually assume the mantle of the world's current regent, which has, for the time being, assumed the burden of responsibility for world stability and peace. Geostrategic success in that cause would represent a fitting legacy for America's role as the first, only, and truly global superpower.